Accession number 9955, reel number 18.
Mr. Calvert, reel 18. You were telling me about the restaurants you went to. What sort of...
Well, they were like a night club, nightlife, and it was full of ladies of easy virtue, and sex was freely offered for fruit, like a banana or orange or tint fruit, soap, and meat, bully beef, or anything in short supply. The naval blockade had done its business without doubt when I was in Cologne just a few weeks after the armistice.
Did many people take advantage of such offers?
Well, I don't know. But the hung around the barracks, and anyway, they'd offer you sex if you could supply them with anything. They were desperate.
You wouldn't have anything to do with them, did you?
No, I had nothing to offer them. I wasn't in a position to get it, you see. Because the people who could get it with those would be where the canteen were. Where I had a long way to go to the canteen, and I was quite satisfied with what I was receiving in the food line. But...
While you were out there, did you ever think of leaving the army, or what were your feelings about it?
I thought of joining for a further period, but my parents said I should come home and renew life again at home.
What made you decide? How did you go about deciding? Your parents wanted you back, you were thinking of staying. What made you decide with their way, so to speak?
I think the decision came when I arrived back in Chelsea Barracks to the old barrack room system.
So you hadn't made your mind up when you left?
No. You see, I'd been living in good conditions in Germany.
When did you leave Cologne?
About April.
So you had Christmas there?
Yes, and along with two or three more officers' servants, a chap equivalent to, I think he'd be the town clerk over here, something like that, invited us into his home. He had a Christmas tree and it was decorated, and two girls there, only about 12, 14, they'd been all the time in Switzerland being educated. Or in other words, they were sent there to avoid the what was happening in Germany. And he'd brought them back for Christmas. And he provided wine. And he said he was sorry, but he couldn't supply us with any food. And the girl got on the piano and... between them, and they sang German songs. It gave us a nice evening. I enjoyed it.
How did you communicate in things? You didn't speak German, did you?
No, we understood a little bit of it, but the Germans spoke English. I had no difficulty in going around Cologne. You'd always find someone who could understand Sprechen Deutsch or Sprechen English, whatever it was, and... you could get that passed.
So, nothing. You carried on this routine as an officer's servant right up to April, did you?
Yes, except for a parade.
Oh, that, yes.
I went on one parade, and that was when all the brigade colours were brought out from London to Cologne, and they were going to be presented on parades. And I was told to join the 4th Battalion to go on the parade, which the 4th Battalion had been made up by various numbers to a battalion again, but only for one day. It was in a parade at a park, I forgot the name of the park, and it was the in the afternoon. It was the Prince of Wales was presenting them. He was a major on the staff of the Guards Brigade at that time. Well, the military police were around in force, and all German civilians who didn't take off their caps or hats, whatever they were wearing, to the colours when they were marched past in the through Cologne itself, they were knocked off. And if they refused to take them off on request, they were arrested and taken into the barracks. And
did most of them do it?
A lot did, yes, a lot did comply with it, because they realised that, like anywhere else, I mean, if they'd have been German colours, we wouldn't have ignored them, we should have saluted them just the same. I mean, it was, you don't salute it because of the colour, it's because of what has taken place. The people who've died through the colours. And we got back into the barracks to be dismissed, and there were a table laid there, and there were two officers there and an interpreter. And these Germans were being brought up one by one and fined, I think, 10 or 20 marks. They were a fine of some sort, and if they paid, then they were released. If they didn't, they were held while somebody came and paid. It was a lesson, I think, really, to show that we might be easy on some things, but we could still enforce others if we wanted.
When was that parade?
That was the beginning of 1919.
So January?
Yes, of January 1919. Well, it was a very big day, that. And as soon as the parade was over, the battalion was disbanded. Ceased to exist.
Had you met any people who you knew who'd served in the 4th?
No, I didn't meet one. Only the chaps I'd served within the 2nd Battalion. I found the barracks where they were, and I was able to go and see them. I went out with them. Used to go out with them at the evening.
I meant when this 4th Battalion was reformed, you know,
didn't
for the day.
Not one.
Not a one still.
Not one, no. No, there'd been, those who I originally knew had been killed, captured or wounded in that Aysbrook area in 1918. That ceased till they'd all gone.
So how did you come to go back home? Was the first, the second posted back to England?
No, I was due for leave. I should have gone to leave a long time before, but owing to the shortage of manpower, and mind you, we were short, they didn't allow much leave at all. The idea was keep going, get the German on the move. And if you'd allowed a percentage on leave, you see, over an army, you'd have had quite a number missing, wouldn't you? Of a battalion, so many percentage allowed. I was about the first for leave when it became allowed. And I saw the officer, and he came to see me off. And crossed to Dover, and 14 days home. And I got a telegram then ordering me to report back to the 2nd Battalion in Chelsea Barracks.
So the 2nd Battalion had come home as well?
As a full battalion. It was the first battalion back home from the British Expeditionary Force to come back as a complete battalion. We were...
That's April.
Yes, and... The tale what was told, why we'd been brought back so early, was in view of civil disobedience likely to spread in the country. And the battalions who went out to take over the occupation of Germany were those 18-year-old, all called up as soon as they were 18, or just before, and they were all the 18-year-old, full battalion. Mind you, the elderly NCOs, well, I mean elderly chaps, 30 and 35 NCOs and officers, but the troops themselves were 18 year old, and they took over and they brought back the whole of the Guards Division into London because they were frightened. The rumours were going around regarding there'd be a big upheaval, strike and civil disobedience.
How did you feel about that? Because that's your own countrymen you'd be having to enforce.
Well, I should have done as I'd been told. If they'd have brought the law and shown violence, I should have stood my ground.
And were people saying that in the Guards?
Yes, they said, yes, we'll deal with it if it comes.
And was there any sign of it? Were you ever employed in that way?
No, but it took place in 1921. Do you remember that? In history. There was a big strike in 1921.
That's when you were recalled, wasn't
it? Yes, we were all recalled.
We'll come to that. Were you back into the barrack routine then?
Yes, and it was shocking. Shocking.
What was shocking about it? I mean, you were an old guardsman. Yeah. You were used to it, weren't you?
Well, I'd comfort for a few months, like home life again. I'd lived a nice life, civilian life practically. And when I got back to the barracks, the routine was shocking.
What didn't you like about it?
Well, everything was dilapidated. It had been used for hundreds and hundreds of troops for years. Everything was dilapidated. There was no hot water. Everything, if you wanted to go to the toilet, you had to go down a lot of steps and across the square. There were latrines there, but not the toilet you found necessary happened during the night. So, and it was a reorganisation taking place. You're put down for happening a duty, and chaps didn't know it happened being removed the day after, and they hadn't seen it. And you see, it was in the process of reorganisation, a battalion taking home station again. It was a bit of a mix-up.
What about spit and polish? Was that back?
Yes, that was beginning to... yes, you had to start cleaning your kit and getting ready for parades and that. It was a big thing to change over a battalion on the process of demobilising the biggest part of it and all your NCOs mainly, and try and reorganise for public duties.
Is this what changed your mind then about staying on?
Yes, I think it did. Yes, it. I thought I'd done 5 years nearly then. I think. I'd done over the. I was on reserve anyway. I'd done the reserve part of reserve service. I think it was four years probably. So I went and gave me name in at the centre, which was dealing with it in the barracks, and they issued me with the necessary equipment. By that I mean passes and various things, and allow you out of the barracks, and railway warrants, and off you went. And Ripon was the place I was demobilised from. You went there and you just dumped rifles, bayonets and everything. And there were a lot of suits on display, hats, shoes, and you could tell them which one you wanted, style and colour, and they measured you, more or less. And that was sent on by post. And that was your demobilising outfit. And anybody wishful there, you know, could have, what I could see of it, you could have got away with rifles and bayonets and any amount of equipment. It was just simply done. There was nothing to stop you picking it up and going out of the barracks when it was dark. It was a big camp. You could have found a way out, probably. So, but nobody were in a hurry to take anything. They were all glad to throw it away. So,
And what date were you demobilised? Do you know?
End of April.
So almost immediately?
Yes, as soon as I got back.
What did you go? What were your plans for civilian life then?
Well, I really hadn't any. The chap I'd mated with from going to school, he'd been called up at the age of 18 into the South Staffordshire Regiment. And he was demobilised. He was through the latter months of the war, he managed to survive. So we picked up from there, and he had work to go to, and I had a job.
What was your job? How'd you got it?
It wasn't much of a job. It was in textile.
So you didn't go back to engineering? Light engineering?
No, I wouldn't have it. No, I went into, through my father's influence, he was a boss in a textile, sponge cloth manufacturing, as they call it. He got me in there.
And that was
that kept me going until I, yes it was, could have stopped there. But I thought, well, this is no life much, and I went to America and Canada. I went to Canada first, away about 18 months, and then America. I worked my way through and then back to England.
When was that you went there?
Oh, 1922 happened, 23.
And then what did you do when you came back?
Well, when I came back, I joined the police force.
And that's where you made your career, I know.
Yes.
There's one thing I'd like you to talk about. I believe that it was your army record, in a sense, held back your promotion in the police. Now, that's quite interesting. Can you just explain
that
was?
The reason was this. I'd refused to take anything to do with promotion in the army. I'd been in 4 years. I was fully aware of all what took place, drills and whatever it was. And when I was in the division under a superintendent who was an ex-Coldstream guardsman, he sent for me, he said, you've qualified promotion, I know, he said, and that, he said, but I've tried, he said, but I can't get beyond the fact that you wouldn't take any responsibility when you served in the regiment. He said, and as you know, the chief constable is an ex-colonel, and the assistant chief constable is an ex-lieutenant colonel, and they look for men who's had responsibility. He says, you haven't. He says, and you know, that's your stumbling block. And I was acting sergeant, but I never got made full.
And that block carried on throughout your years in the police, did it?
Yes.
How long was that then?
All from about 15 years service.
Did that upset you? Did you think that was fair that they looked back at that?
Well, candidly, I never thought much about it, because I'd always been pleased that survived, and I wasn't right wishful to take a lot of responsibility. I'll put it, I didn't want responsibility.
But in the police, you wanted promotion. Did you think it was unfair?
No, I wasn't quite taken up with promotion either, because putting it this way, the biggest part of those who I served under all were sergeants, inspectors and all that. They've all gone. There's only me and another chap left out of going back to the 1920s, still living. They've all gone, you see. The responsibility must be such that they got on the way to passing out.
So it didn't make you bitter?
It didn't, no, I never bothered. I spent 17 years as in the Police Federation as chairman, secretary and then chairman of the Constables Board. I was agitating for improvements in the police service for 17 years, and that of course made me a red.
So you wouldn't have got promotion anyway, probably?
Well, you never know, do you? Well, that was the explanation he gave me, and I think it was quite true.
Now, you were in the Army Reserve. Were you called up before you were called up in 1920? This is going back a bit, but
yes.
It's just tidying up another bit. Were you called up any other time other than 1921?
No.
Well, could you take me through the 1921 time then? You described how you got to the barracks. You
were, yes.
You issued your kit, and then you woke up in the morning and there was your old friend. I've got yes. his name momentarily, but what happened from there?
I went into the barrack room and it was in total darkness, and I was told to find a place. Sergeant says, "You're in the army now, you do as you're told." He says, "Get in there and find a place." So I found a place to get down, and Rivalli next morning, 6, on the floor next to me was Malin. Well, I was very surprised. Last time I'd seen was going out on this patrol to find the Germans, and I found him instead. So he told me then the full story, what had happened.
You told me that, yeah. Yes, earlier. Mm-hmm. What happened from there with you?
Well, we kept together, and after about 3 months.
So you were called up for 3 months?
After about 3 months, yes. The tension had gone out of the strike business and things were back to normal. Yep. And we were released. We were formed up and released.
How did you cope then? For 3 months you were back in the army. You'd been in civilian life for a year, nearly 2 years. How did you cope with it?
Oh, I enjoyed it again. Yes, we were in Purbright camp, and we wasn't overworked or over-drilled or anything like that. We had there were football matches in the afternoon. And
Which unit had you been called back up into?
2nd Battalion Grenadiers.
So your old unit?
Yes, back to the same company and same platoon. And there were few there I met again, who were a chap called Belitha from Stoke-on-Trent. And
Was the drill and the ball and the training and the spit and polish, was that all fairly similar in 1921 as it had been during the war, or was it more or less?
Well, to a certain extent, it was. The training was drilling a lot, was kept up in the discipline, but they didn't do very much with us. You see, they didn't bother us to a great extent. We attended parades and one thing and another, but they didn't have us on guard duty. And
just the reserves, or is it the whole?
Just the reserve.
So the reserves. Well, although you were in your old platoon, etc., you were a man apart.
The more or less, the NCOs didn't bother us very much. They left us apart, you see. It was really a holiday.
What about the trouble? Were there any signs of the civilian unrest and the strikes that you saw?
None.
Do you know of any preparations that had been made? Were there any signs of precautions or things that the military authorities had done? I think you mentioned there were some armoured cars in your square.
There was at Chelsea Barracks, yes, at that time, an armoured car, and no one was allowed out. There was a strict guard kept, and
how long was that for?
Well, for about 8 days.
And when were you called up?
And then, before we were allowed to go any further, we were on the way to Purbright camp.
So the main period of tension was the first 8 or 9 days?
Yes, I think so.
And then you were moved off to Purbright and it all relaxed?
We were there they were bringing coal in from on the Southampton line. There was a canal by Purbright as well, and there was artillery camp further on as well. And they were on the same footing as us.
But you never had to actually go out and mix with civilians, picket lines or anything like that?
No, there was nothing at Purbright. You had to go to Woking, I think, to get to civilians. It was right out in the... We did a little shooting there and drilling and football match and tug of war. It made it quite pleasant for us. So we were paraded one morning until we were being released, and they gave us a warrant to travel back.
Were you pleased?
Yes, I thought it'd be a change. The civilian clothes had been kept in a... wrapped up, then they were handed back to you. There was one chap, though, he was such a big chap, they couldn't get a uniform to fit him, and he had to march and go for it in civilian clothes. He, chap about this width. He were a big chap. Yes, he marched from Chelsea barracks in, and civilians passing and looking, thinking he were a prisoner and being arrested. He must have felt a bit keen about it.
Did he get a uniform eventually?
No, no. They'd have had to make one special for him. So they didn't bother. They just left him there. He was there in case of emergency, I think. It was laughable.
How did you feel about the first one? Looking back on the whole thing, that you joined up and all the rest of it. How, in retrospect, did you think it had done bad or good for you, mentally and physically? You know, what did you think about the whole experience? Was it worth it?
Well, it was an experience which I should never have had without having gone there. And it's something which a lot of people would also like to have gone through, I believe, for the understanding it gave them of people who had to deal in later life with other people. It gave you an outlook on life, a broader one, so that you could see the other chap's point of view, or whoever it was, and not try to impose yours onto them, which if you work in one place, you get a certain narrow channel, don't you?
Did it do you any, so it didn't do you any damage mentally?
No. No, I think it the training and that, I think, has helped me to live to the age I am. Apart from this knee, of course, I can get around fairly often. I'm only handicapped with a bit of stiff leg sometimes. And I don't go to the doctor. I've never been to a doctor for a long, long time. So I think I'm lay that down to the training and the good plain food I got in the army.
Did you think they looked after you after the war as well as they should have done? That, not you particularly, perhaps, but I mean generally.
No, they didn't. No. No, it was a shame the way the ex-servicemen were treated. You weren't wanted. I've heard people say, some of them had to come back, your so-and-so would have had to keep his job or her job, because they had to give you your job back. And people had gone into that and didn't want to leave it. Although, some places, no ex-servicemen need apply. You had the town all burnt down in Luton, hadn't you, at that time? Through that. The way they treated the ex-servicemen, they didn't want to know anything about you.
And did you share that feeling?
Yes, I felt... you see, not far from me, there lived a couple and their son had been killed. And they said to someone who told me it should have been me who'd been killed, because I had gone seeking it, and their son hadn't, he'd been called up. And that was the sort of attitude you were up against. Lloyd George said, what was it? A land fit for heroes to live in. It was all baloney, that. They didn't want to know you as soon as you were away, off the strength of the army, and that. Nobody wanted to know anything about you. A better deal to the Canadians, apparently, and Australians and New Zealanders and Americans than what we ever had. So that was the way it worked out.
I'd like now just to go back to ask a few more questions about the events of the 9th and 10th at Le Havre. You've said that you went out of the... Could you explain the exact context of it again for us, and we'll perhaps run through it in a bit more detail?
Well, I heard this shouting. I was in camp, and I walked out, and lower down the road there was this huge gathering of soldiers.
Now, which camp was that?
That was the camp. It's not Le Havre, it's higher up than Le Havre.
So you were on the Le Havre, the road leading into Le Havre from the camp?
Yes, it was a very big camp, thousands in this camp. And I heard this shouting and I walked down when I saw these hundreds of soldiers. And I saw these officers in the centre, staff officers they were, red tab. And there was a few soldiers, very excited, shouting at them. And the main theme was they wanted to go into Le Havre, all restrictions lifted, to be paid. And then there was something about demobilisation. A rumour got around at that time, I forgot to tell you. A rumour got around, and I heard it, that